Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Evan Haefeli, an associate professor of history at Columbia University, where he specializes in colonial American and Native American history. He is the author of several books, including New Netherland and the Dutch Origins of American Religious Liberty, out from University of Pennsylvania Press, and Captors and Captives, the 1704 French and Indian Raid on Deerfield. He is currently working on another manuscript, tentatively entitled Catholics, Protestants, and Empire, Constructing Religious Liberty in Colonial America. Stuff which really piques my interest, and that is why he is with us today. You can find his books over at our website, so what are you waiting for? Get over there and click on them. Evan, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
A little confession to start off things with here, and that relates to how I came across your work on the New Netherlands. Given that I'm the consummate academic, I'm always looking up my books on Amazon.com to see how well I'm doing in sales, and occasionally I notice that I break the 1 millionth bestseller there, so I usually crack open a beer and celebrate when that happens. But every time I go and do a search on my book, your book, The New Netherlands and the Dutch Origins of American Religious Liberty, pops up. So I guess we are linked forever there in the ethereal world of the interwebs.
Yes, very very fortunate, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is pretty kind of cool. And so I have to say, you know, usually I look at it and I say, oh, that looks pretty interesting. But it was a couple months ago, I broke down and I said, I'm going to buy this thing. I bought it in hardcover, I should add. And I am enjoying it immensely. I have to say, for a modern historian, you really have a great sense for written rhetoric, which I think is an art that's been lost in recent decades by historians.
Oh, thank you. Academic writing is a bit of an issue. I went out of my way to make sure that this book was as good a read as I could make it and accessible to a wide range of people, not just my fellow professors, because I know it's something that a number of people are interested in who aren't in the academy, and I wanted to make this history, open this history up to them.
And it is. It's one of these histories that you don't necessarily know much about, especially if you went through the American education system. We talk about religious liberty and the pilgrims, and occasionally they'll get a mention that, oh yeah, they went over to the Netherlands and then they sailed over here. But you know, little do we know or little do we remember that the New Netherlands were part of our colonial history, and it's the Dutch have played an important role here. But here's one thing I don't understand. When I looked up your website at Columbia University, I noticed the obligatory faculty picture of you, but you're standing in front of the Egyptian pyramids. You're a colonial American historian looking at the Dutch. What's with the pyramids there?
Well, I like to travel, I gotta say, but that's actually, there's a professional reason for that. I was invited by a group of scholars, legal scholars, sociologists, political theorists, and some historians and anthropologists who are doing a long-term project trying to rethink religious freedom and what it means. And that was actually a little side trip we did while we were in Cairo for a conference last January on religious freedom in the Middle East.
Very interesting. I just happen to be involved in one of these multi-scholar religious freedom projects as well. We're going to have to compare notes at some point in time. So have been a fun and interesting trip.
Yeah, it was. Oh, I did look up your book on Amazon as well. And what I think one of the things I appreciate about what you did, which is partly what I'm doing with this book here, is to get Americans to think outside the usual borders of, you know, the U.S. and to think about things like religious freedom, religious liberty, religious tolerance in a more comparative and global perspective.
Yeah, that is a very important thing to do. And your book really highlights the fact of how this originates and develops over time, and not very easily all the time, in the case of Holland or the Netherlands. And so let's go ahead and talk about the Dutch origins of religious liberty here in the U.S., but also there. And I have to begin with a question that really begs my interest about the Netherlands. Basically, what is or are the Netherlands? I've heard that country called Holland. It's been called the Low Countries. They use the adjective Dutch. Then it's the Netherlands. I don't understand that. Explain what this whole thing, the Netherlands, is.
Yeah, it's a mix of a geographic and a political concept. And it's the Netherlands just means, you know, it's another way of saying Low Countries. It's a flat region around the mouths of the Rhine and the Maas and a few other rivers that had, until the 16th, 17th century, been a part of the Holy Roman Empire. So an extension of, you know, the sort of Deutschland world. And Dutch is a word that the English in the 17th century apply to people from what we would now call Germany, as much as people from Holland. They might make a distinction between Low Dutch and High Dutch, but Dutch was sort of a generic term for all of these people. So they speak a Germanic language. Not everybody in the Low Countries, the southern half, you know, that part of what's now Belgium, is primarily French-speaking. And Holland is just one of the provinces. There was a number of different provinces like Utrecht and Zeeland and Flanders, which in the middle of the 16th century were put under the ultimate governing authority of the Holy Roman Empire emperor, who also became the King of Spain, and the King of Spain retained sovereignty over this territory. And it was against his rule and his religious policies, which involved basically ramping up the Catholic Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, and increasing strictness of religious observance, bringing in the Inquisition to persecute heretics, Protestants, that the people in that area revolted. And there was a long war, the 80 Years War, and what you have in the end in the current countries of what we now call Holland and Belgium and Luxembourg is actually sort of the fallout of how that war wound up, with the Spanish forces ultimately retaining control of the southern provinces and the rebels gaining liberty in the north. The independence was not acknowledged until 1648. And that's an important part of the story that I'm telling here, because they're colonizing the world and colonizing America at the same time as they're fighting this huge Catholic empire for their own independence back home.
And it must also be part of the story that they're out on the periphery of the Holy Roman Empire. And I'm taking a look here at the map of the Netherlands, and it's just a mishmash of a lot of different people that don't seem to naturally have a unifying theme, other than they just don't want to be part of the Habsburgs or, you know, Spain or anything like that. I mean, they got the Frisians up north with their entire different language, and so that must be somewhat difficult to smush all these people together in something called a country.
Yes, exactly. And then French speakers. The revolt actually started in the south, and some of the most militant Protestants were in the south rather than the northern provinces, which is an important dynamic during the revolt. So a lot of refugees from the south, including French speakers, moved up to the north. And then because it's on all these rivers, and it was one of the most heavily urbanized regions of Europe, it was very cosmopolitan and had been since, you know, for several hundred years since the Middle Ages, had widely developed trade networks across Europe. So it was a region that was predicated more on its connections to the outside world rather than with each other, if that makes any sort of sense. And it's only the war and the revolt that brought them together in a very artificial kind of way, you could say. There was no nation, there was no Dutch nation, basically, before the Dutch revolt happened.
I can imagine that plays out, too, in terms of its religious diversity. When you talk about this 80 Years' War, that's breaking out shortly after the Protestant Reformation has been spreading, you know, a couple decades after, but, you know, things move a little slower back then. And I would assume that there's a mishmash of all different types of religious faiths at this point in time. In Belgium, you kind of, you know, think of both as Catholic and Protestant, and then, you know, Germany, you got the Lutherans and stuff. So there must have been a huge mix of faiths in that area at the time, right?
Well, yes, and because a lot of these religious ideas traveled along these trade networks, a lot of ideas, the whole Reformation kind of passed back and forth through the Netherlands, and many of those ideas that wound up in England came out of the Netherlands originally. So there were some Lutherans, and then very early on, there were a lot of Baptists, or, you know, Anabaptists they were called at the time, but the people who became Mennonites and, you know, ultimately contributed to the Baptist movement of the 17th century were very strong at the early in the very radical early in the Reformation period. But ultimately, the real spearhead of the revolt and the people who gained control of the politics and the church of the independent Dutch Republic were Calvinist, Reformed Protestants.
Give us a sense on how the Calvinists more or less took control of the territory. Again, you know, part of your story is really to tell that they didn't have complete control, that there's often, you know, a superficial control and a lot of things happening underneath the surface. But how does the Dutch Reformed or the Calvinist Reformed Church emerge as the dominant, or at least the predominant church in the region?
It's the nature of the Reformed Church. This is one line of interpretation, made it very effective in that sort of atmosphere. It didn't have a strong hierarchy from on top. So you could organize congregations locally and then ally, you know, with various councils or, you know, presbyteries, depending on how they did it at the time. But they didn't need bishops. They could take care of a lot of the business themselves. And then they were the most politically and religiously militant. So not everybody who began the Dutch revolt was a Protestant. A lot of Catholics supported the revolt for political reasons. But as the war went on, the people who were the most committed to the cause of independence and the most anti-Spanish, and then, of course, also the most anti-Catholic, were these Calvinists. And they came to exercise more influence in the religion and politics of the Dutch Republic than their actual numbers would necessarily account for that reason. So they were in the situation of having a lot of power, but actually being something of a minority demographically.
Mm-hmm. And that is interesting, and I'm sure that's going to have an effect on how the story plays out here. What about non-Christians? I know that Judaism has a history in the Netherlands, and they are oftentimes associated with cities like Antwerp or Amsterdam.
Yes, although they had been basically driven out of the Low Countries as well as England and northern France in the late Middle Ages, so there wasn't any Jewish community in the mid-16th century at the time of the revolt. By the 1580s, you do start seeing some Jewish individuals settling down in Amsterdam in particular. And these are people that at the time were called Portuguese, and they were descendants of the people who had to flee Spain and had been forcibly converted so-called New Christians is another name, and those were people who exercised a very, a number of them played an important role in the Spanish and Portuguese imperial trade networks, and it's through those networks and then through the possible and through the trade connections with the Low Countries that some of those people wound up in the Netherlands. And then once they were there, the way that the Dutch managed religion, which is they didn't allow any other church other than the Reformed, the Dutch Reformed Church, to exist publicly.
That is an interesting thing you bring up in your book. You said that there's this interesting tension between how the religious landscape is navigated, that the Reformed Church wanted to bring people into the state or public church, as you call it, but right. It's also very difficult to do that. And explain that tension and how that played out.
Well, the Calvinists, if they had had complete control over everything, they would have forced people to go to church and to conform and be part of the Dutch Reformed Church, much as was the case in England, for example. You know, the whole story of the Puritans is in this religious dissent is because there was these laws and official pressure that forced people to participate and be a member of the national church. You didn't have any other option. The Dutch revolt, it's largely because it began as this revolt against the pressures for religious conformity coming from the Spanish government, with the Inquisition as the great incarnation of that, had embedded at its very core this belief in liberty of conscience, that you could not force someone to believe something, and you couldn't force them to be a member of your church. However, you could deny them other options, and that it's a sort of a subtle distinction, and that's really what they ended up doing. Because this belief in liberty of conscience was so great, the Dutch, for a number of political reasons, never forced Catholics, for example, to become Calvinists. However, they didn't let Catholics have their own churches, they didn't let Catholic priests circulate, they didn't allow people to celebrate the Catholic Mass. And that was this sort of very fine and fuzzy distinction that it was really characteristic of Dutch tolerance. And for some people, like Catholics, that could come across as oppressive. But for Jews, that was actually quite liberating, because they could go there. They didn't have to pretend, they didn't have to be Christian, you know, they didn't have to claim to be Christian anymore, as they had to in the Iberian world. So they could just start doing their own thing, as long as they basically kept it private. And that is really where the line was drawn in the Dutch world, is a strong sense of a difference between the public and the private profession of religious belief.
And one of the things I have to ask here is that they're fighting a war against the Habsburgs, and now you admitted that the Catholics, or there were a number of Catholics that were interested in breaking away from Spain just as much as any of the other Protestants, and in fact, they might have been instrumental early on in the revolt. But were there any instances where Protestants said, hey, you guys brought the Inquisition here a few times, we're just going to go beat up a few Catholics? Was there any tension there, or was it just a live and let live attitude that developed?
That would partly depend on who you ask. Catholics there were, especially early in the early days of the revolt, there was a number of, some priests and monks were killed by some of the militant Calvinist rebels. Churches were seized by the state. Priests, if they wanted to remain a priest, were driven out of the country or forced to go underground. It wasn't a sustained campaign of harassment the way the Inquisition was, but they were definitely made to feel, at least the religious figures were allowed, made to feel, leaders were made to feel unwelcome. And over the course of the revolts, depending upon how well or badly the war was going, there could be a fair amount of tension in relations between Catholics and Protestants in the Netherlands. So it was, at times it could seem pretty easygoing. A number of the, some of the richest merchants in Amsterdam, for example, were Catholic. But at other times, there could be tension. There might be occasionally riots, and there were certainly constant denunciations of Catholics and Catholicism coming from the pulpits of the Dutch Reformed ministers.
Yet nonetheless, the government or whoever gains control here does let them continue doing their thing. And one of the chapters that you have in your book is called Connivance. And that is a really interesting word. And when I first saw that, I scratched my head. Each of your chapters has a, you know, one word title to it, which is kind of a neat rhetorical device. And, but that the other ones I understand quite a bit, but connivance, that seemed really kind of strange. What, but you connect this very well to what was going on in the Netherlands circa in the early to mid 1600s. What do you mean by connivance, and how does that play into religious toleration?
Sure. Well, you hit on one thing that I did quite purposely with the book is there's a number of key words, you know, toleration, non-Christians, liberty of conscience, which are involved in interpreting or understanding what Dutch tolerance was and how it worked. And what I did is I took the particulars of what was happening in New Netherland and tied it up with the broader Dutch history and used it to bring out particular themes, you know. And so the connivance is one of the crucial ones, and it's very, well, it's particularly fuzzy because it's really about the issue of enforcement. So there's laws on the books about what can and cannot be done in terms of religious practice. But in any particular case, what really matters is what the local magistrates, you know, sheriffs or governors are going to allow people to get away with. And connivance is generally a negative term.
Mm-hmm. Sounds conniving, doesn't it?
It doesn't sound very good yet.
No.
Today. And this was going against the grain of most political and religious thought at the time, which believed that religious unity, religious truth was the most important thing, and allowing people to practice or pursue error is not just a bad thing, but potentially dangerous for your community's relationship with God. Nevertheless, for a variety of reasons in different situations, and this could be anything from Catholics bribing a local magistrate to just sort of look the way other way when their priest was in town, to a particular political faction controlling the magistracy and having good relations with people of other faiths and deliberately avoiding implementing the full extent of the law and allowing people to gather in groups and homes with a minister, you know, a Lutheran minister, say, or a Catholic priest to worship. But there was no written code on how to do this or not do this, and it would vary. It could be sort of expanded or contracted or turned on and off over time, depending upon who was involved, where you were, and what the broader context was.
As a political economist, I was very fascinated by the fact that there were side payments, or as we would call them, bribes, in order to allow this toleration or looking the other way, or I think you also mentioned a wink of an eye saying, yeah, you're not supposed to be Catholic, but it's okay, right?
Yeah.
You know, as long as you don't cause any disturbances.
Yeah.
As long as you don't have big processions down the street with crosses and all that kind of crucifixes or whatever, it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite expression in those lines is they would say, if you look through your fingers at something, you know, if you hold your fingers in front of your face and look at something, it blocks off certain aspects of what's actually going on. And, Yeah, sometimes it was money, and sometimes that could be controversial, and other times it was politics, and sometimes it was a certain kind of pragmatism where if almost everybody in town, you know, is Catholic, it's going to be very hard to suppress them or to find out what's going on, and then it might, you know, they might start a riot, depending upon circumstances. So there's a recognition also that there were limits to what could be enforced, regardless of what the ideals or the laws were.
Mm-hmm. Now, this brings up an interesting question regarding the difference between toleration and religious liberty, and we oftentimes conflate those two issues. And the story that is being told here is really one of toleration developing. It's not so much of religious liberty put into jurisprudence or into a legal format that everybody can see, but it is this look the other way and just gradually evolve toward greater toleration, right?
It's mostly that. The Dutch term was liberty of conscience, and a lot of these struggles I talk about in the book are over what that meant and how far did that extend. So I was very happy to find. So conscience was a very important term, particularly remains so today, but at the time it was this idea that there was this, everyone had their conscience, and that is what was their supreme connection to their sense of religious and moral propriety. And to go against what their conscience was telling me was right, was telling them that God or scripture was demanding of them, was by a number of people seen as sinful, and as sinful as any other sort of persecution, even if their conscience was leading them to dissent from the established church.
And that is interesting, because you bring up another point that was fairly interesting with respect to the Reformed Church was trying to bring people into the public church. It's an evangelizing church. It wants people to join and to become members and to believe its theology, as many churches do. But it seemed that for some groups, like the Jews, well, they're probably not going to convert, so we can leave them more or less alone. But what about folks like the Lutherans? They're kind of close to that. Was there a little bit more tension there? You know, I could see the Calvinists saying, well, you've almost made it through the door, but we're going to have to nudge you or push you a little bit further to get you through the door.
Oh, yes, and they talk about it. Even some of the Dutch ministers in my book are saying there's really no significant difference between us and you, so you might as well just join with us. And there are some Lutherans would convert. And also because they were so close, there's a lot of Lutherans in the Dutch world, because many of the soldiers and the sailors and the workers in places like Amsterdam and then also in the colonies were Germans or Scandinavians, all in, you know, from the northern Germany and Scandinavia. Many of them had grown up Lutheran. So that was one of the big issues in the Dutch world. And by the mid-late 18th century, the Dutch did start to make exceptions and allow Lutherans to form their own congregations, as they had in, as they were starting to do in the Netherlands as well. But in the 17th century, in the period I'm talking about in this book, that was still very, that was not allowed yet. And the Lutherans are one of the people struggling to form a congregation in New Netherland. But the Dutch authorities and the Dutch Reformed ministers basically win the fight to keep a Lutheran minister out of a colony and to force the Lutherans to attend the church. And they proudly note any time they see Lutherans converting to and joining the Dutch Reformed Church.
Whenever you think of the Netherlands, you oftentimes think of trade. That's one of the great trading nations that develops early in the modern European history. And I'm always fascinated by the role that trade and also colonialism played in conditioning Dutch toleration here. I know I'm a big fan of Adam Smith, and he wrote in Wealth of Nations that a merchant has no nation. He only wants to sell his wares and is not interested in the triflings of state. This would possibly seem to apply to religion as well, being that they were, the Netherlands were such a crossroads for so much trade. What role did trade and commerce play in facilitating this emergence of toleration?
That's a trickier question, I think, than we might think. I don't think there's a direct correlation from the one to the other. Many of the most militant Calvinists, for example, were wealthy merchants who did who played leading roles in the creation of the East India Company and the West India Company and expanding Dutch trade and empire overseas. But in doing that, they also wanted to propagate the gospel as they saw, as they understood it. So they didn't, I have not yet seen any merchant who has a sort of anything can go sort of attitude. They, many of them were quite convinced of their, or had very strong religious opinions, we should say. And at the same time, because they had to work with lots of other people, they did not force those people to convert or to conform. But they didn't, you know, the fight was over what sort of options or outlets for expression they would have. And depending upon the time and place, there would be more or less of that. But the merchants were trying to kind of play it both ways. They did, especially in the West India Company, the more work that's being done on that, it was founded to help fight the Spanish Empire, had a very strong militant Calvinist ethos. And even though it was about trade, it was about all these other things, and the spreading the gospel might not have been as important as making money, but it was still there as one of their top three or four goals.
Before we go to the next place, which is taking the Netherlands abroad to New Netherland or Americas, I want to address one more issue, and this connects with a lot of our understanding of American history, is the role of the pilgrims. You mentioned the pilgrims pretty briefly in your book, and it's a, you know, as I say, it's a great read. It's about 300 or so pages, 275 pages, and they get about two or three pages mentioned. What can you tell us about the role of the pilgrims? Were they just an episodic thing in this whole development of religious toleration in the Netherlands, or do they play a more significant role?
Their, you know, their relationship to it is much more, I found out, much more complicated and ambivalent than we are usually led to believe. So they did go to Holland because they would not be persecuted for their religious practices as they were being in England at the time. So the Dutch would let them be there. Now, the pilgrims, they were Reformed Protestants, religiously, theologically, very similar to the Dutch Reformed Church, although they had their quibbles with it and didn't completely join it. But one thing they found is once they're in the Netherlands and they're not faced with persecution, then they're just faced with determining what they're really going to do with each other. And they got into all sorts of fights and had a lot of fallout and schisms and divisions. And some of them actually said, you know, the Dutch Reformed Church is fine, and went off and joined the Dutch Reformed Church. So the experience of Dutch tolerance was actually a very divisive thing for the pilgrims. And that was one of the reasons, I think, why the ones who came to Plymouth left. There were too many options, basically, in Holland, and then in Plymouth, they could basically run the whole show, which is what they did. And they did not create Plymouth as anything like the world that they had experienced in Holland. Quite the opposite. It's a very exclusive, single church atmosphere in the colony, whereas and they were living in the cities in Leiden and Amsterdam, very diverse and lots of different sorts of people. So they were free from persecution, but they were also had a little bit too much freedom that led them to go off in a number of different ways that undermined their communal solidarity.
A very interesting observation, because that is one of the things we do see when religious freedom develops around the world, is you don't run into conflicts with your old traditional enemies anymore, and these little tiny maybe theological disputes or personal disputes allow for this, what one of my colleagues likes to term fissipariousness, nature of Protestantism or of religion more generally. So very kind of interesting. Let's follow the pilgrims over to the New World, to the Americas, and talk about how the Dutch, not so much the pilgrims, but the Dutch get over there. Normally we think of American colonial history, if you went through the standard high school class, of, oh yeah, it's the British, and occasionally there's a few other folks that come in. But the Dutch had a pretty significant presence there. In fact, in reading your book, I was surprised to find out how extensive it was. I had just associated New Netherland with Manhattan, but right. It extends up to Hudson, I think, and gets up to Maine at some points in time, too. Is that correct?
They basically claimed everything from Connecticut to Delaware. They had a trading outpost at what is now Hartford for several decades, and then they had other outposts down on in what's now Delaware, Pennsylvania, southern New Jersey. And then another one at what's now Albany. And so Manhattan was the center of this network of trade posts. And it was they were very thin on the ground presence, because they're mainly interested at first in trading for furs with the indigenous Americans. So it was not a place where they were sending over thousands of colonists like the English were to Virginia, and it was also a place that was under the authority of the West India Company, so it was driven from the center and controlled from the center, and wasn't an effort to escape from Dutch authority like the Puritans were trying to escape from English authorities by going to New England. So it was one small part of a huge operation at the time, which was very ambitious. If it had succeeded, our understandings of the Dutch and, you know, the Dutch speakers would be very different from what it is today. They captured half Brazil for about 20 decades. They took several Caribbean islands. You know, they captured a number of outpost in Africa as well from the Spanish and Portuguese. They were much more extensive and ambitious and powerful than the English were at the time in the mid-17th century, but they overstretched themselves. They lost Brazil to a Portuguese revolt. They lost Angola where they had been, and so by the end of the 17th century, and ultimately they lost New Netherland as well, by the end of the 17th century, all that they had was a couple little outposts in Africa and then a couple of Caribbean islands and Suriname. So but what we see there is just the remnant of this earlier incredibly ambitious effort. And that was the atmosphere at the time that New Netherland was established. So it's not the central focus of the Dutch energies at the time.
Yeah, no, very extensive empire, and we oftentimes forget that of this mishmash of a country that seems to be fairly small and not as powerful as England, but as you point out correctly, that they did have very extensive ambitions. In terms of their presence in the Americas, in what we now call the United States, what was the time frame of their influence? Were we talking about 1620s to 1660s, where are we talking about here?
Well, one thing that people forget, so the reason why New York is New York and not New Netherland is the English conquered the Dutch colony in 1664. However, one thing that people forget about is the Dutch actually, in another war 10 years later, reconquered the colony. And for about another year, it was part of the Netherlands once again, and then got traded back to England in the peace deal. So really from the 1620s to the 1670s, this was a real part of the Dutch world. A roughly 50 year period.
And how are they fitting in the Americas? Because they get a foothold on Manhattan and they go up the Hudson River, and they, again, as you mentioned, they're pretty thinly spread, but you know, they're surrounded by the Congregationalists or Puritans to the north, and they're surrounded by the Anglicans to the south. Is this influencing how, or the spread of religious toleration and how they have to deal with these different religious forces?
Well, you might say so, but that would get to the point I'm making in the book, which is what you had in New Netherland is actually a very conservative version of this Dutch tolerance, of this connivance. The people who were in charge, Peter Stuyvesant, most famously, he's the son of a Dutch Reformed minister, zealous Calvinist, as were the ministers who were in town, a number of his fellow officers in charge of the country, in charge of the colony. They had opened up what's now Long Island to settlement from Puritans from New England. As we all know, there's a variety of people, Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson, the two most famous, who couldn't fit into the religious system developing in New England. Roger Williams went to Rhode Island. Anne Hutchinson went to Rhode Island. She actually ended her life in New Netherland, along with several hundred others, some of them Baptists, some of them Presbyterians, people who were sort of on either side of what became New England Congregationalism. They could fit into the Dutch system quite well, but that meant that there was actually quite a lot of Protestants, a lot of Calvinists, and unlike pretty much everywhere else in the Dutch world, there's hardly any Catholics. And there were some Lutherans, but not as many as in other places. So you kind of had a more purely, not completely pure, but a much more strongly Calvinist society in New Netherland than in many parts of the Netherlands, certainly more than Amsterdam, for example.
Mm-hmm. In part, it's just because they got that territory and you can keep outsiders out for a while, right?
It's partly that, but they would let in, they liked the Puritans. They got along quite well. They had nice things to say about the Pilgrims and Plymouth. They saw eye to eye with them on a lot of ways, and Stuyvesant was even trying to recruit the people from New Haven, which was the most radically conservative Puritan colony in New England, to settle in what's now New Jersey, because he liked them and he respected them. So they did have a sort of, and they were willing to extend a certain amount of tolerance to these people because the New Haveners' way of running their churches is different from the Dutch Reformed way, but theologically they had so much in common that Stuyvesant didn't think it would be a problem at all. And then a lot of these people, some of these people had known each other back in Europe. Some of these New Englanders had been in the Netherlands before they went to New England, and then they wind up in New England. So they were familiar characters to each other.
Now, one of the chapters that you discuss has the title Radicalism, and you talk about the New Amstel outpost and how this ends up in a disaster. Explain what is going on there.
Well, that is the most interesting, if you're interested in experiments in religious liberty, that's the most interesting moment, because for various political reasons, the Delaware River gets removed from the Peter Stuyvesant's authority and assigned, it becomes a separate colony under the control of the city of Amsterdam. In the 1650s, which is a particular moment in Dutch history, religious history and political history, where political and religious radicalism were at something of a high point, especially in Amsterdam. And the people in charge of that particular colony used that moment, as they didn't set up the usual system. They did not set up the public church the way you had in New Netherland. They instead allowed Mennonites, they opened it up to Mennonites and others to set up a different kind of settlement that didn't have any formally organized religion at all, even though still Protestant, still generally under the rubric of the Dutch Reformed Church, but at a much greater distance. And so if you want to make a case between widespread religious diversity and economic development, that was the one time in North America where they really tried it. And it's hard to know what had happened, because the colony really only lasted for about a year before the English Navy shows up and conquers it and dismantles it, and it just sort of vanishes from history, so we'll never really know what the answer would be there.
But they had about a year going on, and it seems like, you know, other than if the British hadn't come, I mean, you have any speculation of how it might have turned out, given the way things were running?
It was tough. You know, there was disease, problems with supplies. A lot of colonies the first couple of years are hard, and they were going through that. Maybe they could have pulled it together if the war had not broken out, but it would have been hard just given what the situation was. And the other interesting thing is that some of the people involved with that colony were actually opposed to slavery, and that is precisely the moment where in the Chesapeake, you know, right across the way there, the slave economy is starting to grow as the tobacco, the use of, you know, the growth of tobacco across the Chesapeake is happening. And so it was a very idealistic settlement in a much less idealistic setting that might not have been able to resist that in the end.
Yeah, but large wedge issue that divided a lot of folks. Let me now talk about how the Dutch lose out on their colonies, and then the broader influence. So, as you mentioned, they're there for about 50 years. There's a little bit of give and take near the end, where they are able to take back some of their territory for about a year from the British. How do they end up eventually getting kicked out of the colonies entirely, or maybe not entirely? And then what kind of residual impact does this have? Does this have an echo that lasts another 100 years and is reflected in the thinking of the founding fathers who then write the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution?
Well, there's many people would like to see some sort of direct connection between what the Dutch were doing and how you get up to the First Amendment. And the main argument of the book is that if there's a connection, it's a very tenuous one. There's not a direct connection, because there's too many major political events, these conquests and turnovers of territory that happen in between. And the whole book is designed to sort of show what the Dutch system was like, to also give people a sense of, if the Dutch had been in charge, it would have been very different from the kind of world that you get with the First Amendment, for example.
How so?
Or even in Pennsylvania, which...
Right.
Well, because you have this so public church system where there would have been one official church people would not have been required to conform to it as they were in the English world. So you wouldn't have had to have, you know, formal tolerations to protect you from the public church, but you also would not have had any right to organize in it as a separate congregation unless you worked out some specific local arrangement with the authorities, which was how it happened everywhere else in the Dutch world. So there would have been some diversity, but if it would have been of the way that the Dutch did it. So you could have had, for example, a Baptist church, but it would have been off the main street, down a back alley, you know, kind of hidden from public view. You could have had, you know, Lutheran churches, but they would have been disguised as houses, and these so-called house churches or hidden churches, which is, again, the way it was done in the Dutch world. Most people might know that that looks like a house, but inside it's really a church. But still, it couldn't formally be built as a church or recognized as a church, and people who were not members of the Dutch Reformed Church would not usually not have full political rights. They would not have the important political offices. So there would have been a hegemony of a sort of this Dutch Reformed hegemony that didn't completely suppress religious diversity, but kept it under control and restraint.
Let me speculate on that a little bit. That's an interesting contention here, and I'm trying to think about this in terms of the Congregationalists as well, as they essentially tried to do the same thing, but just because of the what I would say is easy exit from a lot of these colonies. I mean, the territory was, you know, frontier territory. You could easily escape to somewhere else and set up shop downriver or create your own city. That it would seem difficult to contain that public church system. And I'm almost thinking about the First Great Awakening, where you get these Methodists popping up here and there with their revivals and their circuit riders coming around. And do you think that the public church system of the Dutch that they had in, you know, back in the home country in the Netherlands would have actually been able to resist that or not?
Well, to be honest, I do. If you look elsewhere, like in Indonesia, that's what they had. You know, most of the people were not even Christian, but still the only Christian church from, you know, into the 18th century, well into the 18th century, was the Dutch Reformed Church. And other, you know, there's Chinese Buddhists and Muslims and stuff around, but they did a fairly, it varied, of course, over time, but they did a pretty good job of keeping those things marginalized, those religious practices marginalized or restricted to the domestic realm. And then the thing that strikes me after studying colonial American history for so long is you couldn't actually go off and set up your own colony that easily. First of all, there's the Americans there, you know, the indigenous people, and especially in the 17th century, they're still quite strong and powerful. So you would have to move into their territory. I talk about that a little bit in the book, and live under their authority, or somehow negotiate with that. Second of all, part of the story that you get with New Netherland is there's a Swedish colony, for example, a little Swedish colony that gets on the Delaware River, that gets conquered by the Dutch. The Dutch themselves get conquered by the English. There's always this threat of conquest. These are very small, weak outposts, which it didn't take a whole lot necessarily to overcome. But ultimately, I think what you would have had in the American setup is a much more stronger kind of New England Calvinist type of influence in whatever makeup we would have had, had the Dutch somehow stayed in control for longer, somehow gotten folded into the creation of the United States, because there was a strong affinity between them and the Dutch Reformed. And while not everybody would have been Dutch Reformed, there's no way you would have had the diversity that the English promote after they turn New Netherland into the Middle Colonies. And that's the main argument of my book, is that the reason why you're able to have something like Pennsylvania is because by the time the English gain access to this territory by conquering it from the Dutch, the religious and political situation has changed so much in England that there's a willingness, there's Quakers. Quakers didn't exist when New England was founded. And then just the nature of the religious politics is different, that people are willing to give, some, the king is willing to give Quakers a colony. if the English had controlled that area earlier in the 17th century, it would have been, you know, more like a greater Virginia or a greater Connecticut. And if the Dutch had stayed in control, they would have had a lot more, they would have sort of expanded the kind of reformed Protestant hegemony that you had in New England all the way down to the edge of the Chesapeake, and that probably making it the majority influence in whatever, in what became the territory of the United States. So it would have been a much different, sort of a radically different mix.
A very interesting contention, and I'm going to advise my listeners to go ahead and pick up your book and really dive into this argument that you make there, because I do think it's an utterly fascinating one, and one that acts as a little bit of a corrective to some of the things that I've written in the past, and that's why I enjoy it. That's kind of this ongoing dialogue. I want to finish off with one last question, though, and I ask this of a lot of my guests, and I especially like to ask this of historians, because the reason we understand history, or at least the reason that I study history, is because it tells me something about myself and the current contemporary period that I'm living in. What takeaways did you have from doing this project? Takeaways that you learned something about the broader context of history or something about contemporary life as it is today?
Well, the first takeaway would just to be, you know, after looking at this system of Dutch tolerance so closely, is how different it is from what you might think if you didn't know, you know, just from our common ideas about the Dutch and how they're tolerant. Yes, they were, but in very particular ways that, from, if you look at what they're doing in the 17th century, look very limiting from our modern perspectives. And then I suppose the most relevant takeaway for our present is how closely tied religious possibilities are to political sovereignty and control, and how much changes in the government, change, you know, a revolt or a conquest or, you know, a transfer of authority from one empire to another sets up a very different sort of dynamic, which doesn't, you know, in the Dutch case, there's a strong Dutch Reformed community that persists after the English conquests, and doesn't, you know, doesn't eradicate them, and they become very strong and thriving. But they've lost the control over other people. That's now in the hands of the English, and then they find themselves living in a world which the Dutch Reformed would not have would not have desired if they'd been left to their own devices. So that political power, and its role in this story of religious tolerance is, I think, the main lesson that I've taken out of this study.
My guest today has been Evan Haefele. Evan, thank you very much for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you, Tony. That was a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.